Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm PK, and we're on a bit of a mission to live a low-carbon life.
But what does living a low-carbon life actually mean?
We're continuing with our series on carbon impacts.
And this week, we're looking at housing.
Plus a whole bunch of other random energy-related tips.
Let's go! So in this week's podcast, we're going to be looking at a few different aspects to UK housing in particular. First of all, think about some of the impacts of housing on the climate.
Yeah, and then we're going to discuss some of the solutions around what can save you energy.
And then also broadly, actually, what needs to change to make sure our houses are fit for the future?
Yeah, because the same old isn't going to cut it.
Yeah, it's a bit concerning as we get into this one.
Yes, it is.
So actually, housing on residential properties are responsible for around about 15% of the UK's greenhouse gas emissions. What's difficult with housing is actually the number hasn't been falling much. So for things like electricity, we've seen declines in the amount of carbon which is being produced from electricity because we're changing our electricity mix. But housing, we've not been very good at. It's generally been an area which we're, to just put it nicely, a bit crap at. And I think we're going to expect to see a change from last year and a reduction in the amount of energy we're using on our housing. But that's not a good sign. That's a sign of people in fuel poverty and actually being able to access energy. There's a mixture of people which need to increase their energy and people that need to decrease their energy use in their house as well.
So yeah, I'm glad you addressed fuel poverty and that some people need to increase their fuel. So we have 6.5 million people in the UK that live in fuel poverty. So every year when it's really, really cold outside, they're having to make very, very tough decisions about where their money can be spent.
And I think in reality, the number's probably higher as well, because we have this wonderful philosophy in the UK of we can change the definitions of various important things like fuel poverty to change actually who's in that bracket and who's not. So in reality, actually people that are really struggling to afford fuel is going to be higher.
You are probably right in that the actual number is much higher of people who are really, really experiencing fuel poverty.
Yeah. Actually, what's good about some of the stuff we're going to be talking about today is it's not only a solution to climate change, it's also a solution to the energy crisis that we're in today. And also, if we'd have acted quicker and more efficiently on the energy crisis with some of the plans that had been discussed earlier in the last decade, maybe we wouldn't have the same energy crisis we're having right now.
Exactly.
And I think it's also important to say, actually, within this whole issue of housing, it's not just fuel poverty. Actually, the UK's housing stock is just terrible in terms of heat issues as well. I can't imagine how hot it would be in a high-rise building in the coming years if we could keep having 40-degree summers.
So yeah, so we also need to be considering how our homes being built so that in our hot temperatures, they won't become these virtual ovens for the people living inside of them.
Yeah, it's not just a few houses. It is a grand total of 29 million homes across the UK which need to be retrofitted to reach our 2050 targets. And to give us a bit of an idea of where we're heading, at our current rate, it would take us roughly 700 years to get to that target. And I'm not saying that we won't change in the coming years, because things do evolve quickly, but we probably need to do something to go from 700 years to under 30 years in terms of what we need to with our housing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that information, just if anybody's curious, comes from the UK Energy Research Centre on that 700 year. At the rate we're going, based on current rates, it would take us 700 years.
It's one of those terrifying thoughts, really, actually. It's like, oh, we've got 25 years to fix all these problems. Where are we heading and what's it looking like?
Yeah, 19,000 homes a week must be upgraded to reach that target, which isn't happening, obviously.
There is just not the supply chain and the skills available to do it right now. Like the UK has not prepared for this for the last 30 years to say we need 500,000 people to be skilled in these jobs. We've just said, oh yeah, we'll get to it later, it's fine.
Yeah, which goes back to one of the conversations, one of our earlier podcasts, where we talked about green jobs and green skills. And you made a very good point, was that a lot of the jobs that look like they're in sustainability, you know, climate change specialist, carbon calculator, chief of sustainability at large corporations, the main jobs that are needed for the green industry is really what you said about the construction industry, housing industry, all the industries where they're going into building and retrofitting. Those are the jobs we need. And there's not enough trained people to do the work.
Yeah. And we have so much to do here to address that.
Yeah.
One final negative. Do you want to guess which country has the leakiest homes in Western Europe in terms of energy efficiency?
Is it us?
Oh, yes, correct. The UK has the leakiest homes in all of Western Europe. So we lose roughly 3 degrees of temperature every 5 hours.
Whoa.
And we contrast that with somewhere like Germany, they lose one. Somewhere like Norway, 1.1. But why do you think that is the case, PK? Have you got any thoughts?
I think it's because our homes are some of the oldest also in Western Europe as well, but they're just still continuing not to be built to purpose to fit for the future and be properly insulated. And
Yeah.
like the last home I lived in was built in 1790, which for a lot of people in the UK, isn't necessarily uncommon. But we have all those old homes, and then we have all the new homes that are just being built, for a selling price tag and not necessarily for the future and how much running costs are going to be for that home.
Yeah, the age of the housing stock is a critical element in all of this because we do have really old houses in the UK. But also, we've just kind of had this really short-termist approach to it. For example, back in the early 2000s, a lot of energy came from the North Sea. And we said, oh, yeah, we get most of our home's energy supplied from there. Therefore, we don't have to worry about any energy insecurities. We don't have to worry about price shocks. That's not going to happen to us. We've got the North Sea. And shockingly enough, that hasn't lasted. Particularly as we kind of moved away from oil heating to gas heating, which comes from overseas.
Yeah, I think in 2022, the government estimated at the time that all of our heating for our homes could be supplied by offshore wind by 2030. But those estimates were based upon the current usage at the time. So if it was a 2020 study or document that was released, that's probably, 2018, 2019 data they're looking at. And clearly, the population's growing. Clearly, we have, I think, 180,000 new homes being built every year. Clearly, that is not going to keep up with it.
Well, hopefully it will. It depends.
All right, we got Tom into the hope.
Well, because in reality, actually, we just need to reduce energy demand. That's one of the key aspects of this.
There you go.
And that's through like deep housing retrofit, having extensive things like loft insulation, making sure there aren't 5 million cavity walls which are unfilled, making sure we don't have these heat bridges in houses where you have a like a piece of metal which goes through a wall and sucks in all the cold from outside. And just making sure generally our houses are fit for purpose. But one of the big issues is that actually, why would an energy company which has a lot of power lobbying want that? Because they can't sell as much energy. There's no rational reason for them to want it for their bottom line.
Yeah, that's true. There's not incentive for people that are trying to deliver returns for shareholders.
The age-old problem of the fiduciary duty of a company, eh?
And the ethical obligations. I'm going to cut in there real quick to also say there's another element to this. We have so many beautiful, listed, gorgeous buildings all across the United Kingdom. In certain areas, the regulation is you can't then double pane the windows. So the windows are very, very cold. You're not allowed to add any insulation that would take away from the aesthetic viewing of the building. But if those buildings are going to be continued to be used, then we need to ensure that even our listed older buildings can be upgraded for energy efficiency as well.
Yeah. And that comes nicely to the litany of policy failure we've had over the last 10 years.
I feel like we should have just a special section for policy failure.
It's one of those ones that's particularly bad with this sector. And I'm sure like quite a few people are familiar with all the cut the green stuff from Cameron's government when they just said, oh, yeah, this isn't going to be one of our priorities. They basically made it impossible to build onshore wind. Trying to unpick some of that now with the current government. They scrapped those of energy efficiency standards and they changed some of the rules around solar panels. And some work was done last year which said that actually, if we'd have kept that in place, it would have saved the average household £150 a year by actually just following through from those policies from 2015 when they were scrapped. That's not even that long ago that we've had these issues. And then after that, we had the Green Homes Grant, which was again just a massive failure because no one took up the initiatives. It's just been a decade of poor policy making, and if not longer than a decade, actually.
Which I think really goes to illustrate, given that there are elections coming up in May, local elections, how policies that are enacted at a specific time can be incredibly, incredibly hard, as you noted, to untangle and try to go back to doing what would save people money, but also lower our carbon impact as well.
Yeah. they were meant to be really good. The Future Home Standard was meant to be a really exciting and a new policy to kind of push forward changes. But various developers have also lobbied government to say, actually, that we can't do this.
There seems to be an entire disconnect to what the government wants to say it'll do and support, which is great if there's the support, but the supply chain and the businesses that would be delivering that support need to know well enough in advance because not everybody is certified to do specific things. And then get that workforce ready to go and merge them together. So there's a way where people can actually, we can increase jobs, we can increase some revenue for certain industries, and also save regular homeowners money.
Yeah.
You were the only person on your block that took advantage of the insulation scheme.
Yeah, it's part of the Eco3 scheme, which is now the Eco4 scheme. And we can put some information in the show notes about it as well, because certain households will also be eligible for this. And there's all sorts of retrofit and potentially even solar panels, that sort of thing on properties. On our street, everyone got offered various bits of insulation as part of Eco3. And I was the only person on my street that said yes to it. Afterwards, everyone was like, oh, that's cool. How have you got that? And I was like, they knocked on your door as well.
Yeah, so that was actually a massive marketing failure.
Yeah, I think this comes to one of the major issues that with this sector generally is that the communication around it is absolutely dire. The amount of places I go to and speak to people, and they don't know what to do in terms of the efficiency measures they should take and the action they should be taking as well. It's all just a bit of a maze of complexity. And I think it's also because it's quite hard to understand as well. Like each property is different. Having a solid wall property compared to a cavity wall property means you have to have a different solution. But really, we need to be having someone leading this discussion and say, okay, this is what you should do. This is how you get there. And here's a really, really simple and easy way to understand it.
You're right. There needs to be one site where we could go to and it goes, okay, here's where you go. And then also lists of vendors. This is your type of home. This is who your energy expert is in the area. And every council should be able to have somebody on hand that can address this issue because it impacts councils significantly.
Yeah.
That's it. We fixed it. I hope the government's listening. Energy expert in every council.
So there are obviously various areas that we use energy in the house. I want you to tell me where you think we use the most energy within our house. And this includes gas and electricity, okay? Not just one. I mean, really, preferably, if you could rank these 1 to 4, that would be ideal, okay?
Okay.
So we've got lighting and appliances, water heating,
All right.
cooking, and space heating.
Okay.
Which one do you think uses the most energy? Which one do you think uses the least?
The least is lighting, the most is water heating. Ah, damn it.
This surprised me as well. So the least is our cooking. So we only use 3% of all of our energy in the home for cooking. So a really minute fraction.
Which, in a weird way, we need that to go up a bit because for healthy people and also for carbon reduction, we need to be eating less mass processed food and more whole food. So,
Yeah.
interestingly, that's an area where I wouldn't mind the energy going up a bit.
The next lowest is lighting and appliances. So you're close with that one. That's only 13% of the energy within our houses. And then the big one is actually water heating is only 23% of the energy use in the house. And space heating is 61% of all the energy that someone uses in an
Wow.
average house.
Wow.
And one of the big reasons that it's so high is because in our normal homes, we use gas to heat things. And gas isn't really the most efficient input for output material to make heat. And it's something we'll talk about a bit later on in the podcast as well, when we talk about heat pumps.
Yeah, and how we need them.
Desperately.
Every time a gas boiler goes out, we should replace that with a heat pump.
Exactly. The magic of heat pumps.
The magic of heat pumps.
So I've been on a 2-hour training course where we've discussed heat pumps, and I've come out of it like, what? How does this work? It's literally magic. But I think it's also important to say, actually, that it's not just energy within the home which creates carbon. And actually, there's also a massive carbon impact from creating new homes. And it's one of those things we kind of overlook a little bit, is what we call the embodied carbon that comes with creating things. And homes is a massive source of that. So just to give you a rough idea, in the UK, on average, energy within the homes, that's gas and electricity, is responsible for around about 3 tons of carbon a year. And PK, what do you think roughly is the carbon created from building a new 4-bedroom house? And that includes bricks and mortar and all of the infrastructure that's got to go with it, the roads, the cabling, that sort of thing.
30 tons?
50.
50 tons for each new home, and most of those homes are not being built for energy efficiency.
Yep, exactly. And we don't have to create all that carbon. 80% of the housing which is going to be here in 2050 is already in existence today. We can just retrofit our old homes. So like even an ancient early Victorian home in the UK will only cost around 8 tons of carbon to fully retrofit to a zero carbon standard.
Actually, that gives me a bit more hope. And again, like we linked it back to, this could help with jobs and revenue for specific companies that would be installing and retrofitting these homes.
I can give you some facts and figures on that, PK, actually.
Knock me out.
If we could actually deliver all of these targets, it would offer around about £56 billion worth of health benefits, mainly from cold and damp and stopping people getting ill from cold and damp. That's roughly 6,000 avoided deaths a year associated with it as well. And that's from hot and cold conditions.
That's another element that we fail to consider sometimes when we're thinking about this. It's not just about how much carbon the home is producing or how much demand this puts on our energy systems or how much money we're losing, but the fact that people are literally dying because we are not addressing this as well. And how that strains, and the people that aren't dying, there are people who are sick and having long-term chronic health issues because of these circumstances around not having energy fit homes, and how much strain that puts on our NHS system.
On top of that as well, it would create roughly 500,000 skilled jobs in the UK just from delivering a decent retrofit agenda, which helps us reach our net zero targets. And also, this is the really amazing bit. This is the bit that surprised me the most in many ways. On average, it would only cost the average household £10,000 to do all of this. And I know that that's a lot of money. But whenever I think about it, I always think it's going to be like, oh, just stupid number, £100,000 a house. But actually seeing £10,000 a house, it's not a completely astronomical figure. And as long as there was the right policies and the right support there, it's something that I think is achievable potentially.
With the government schemes, especially if they're marketed properly and citizens are advised properly, could take advantage of those. But they could also possibly be done that 10,000 could be broken up into increments, like rolling out a scheme that will give you the most bang for the pound immediately. So launch the scheme, maybe that's 2,000 to 3,000, get that going and get this, you know, sort of a step-by-step thing where people can do those in increments.
Yeah. And I think that's really important as well. And there's lots of really innovative finance models starting to be discussed at the moment, because actually there's a really quick payback time for a lot of these measures. So for example, moving your loft insulation from nothing to the expected standard, which is like 270 millimeters, something like that, should pay back a household in terms of their energy bill within about 2 years. Similarly, things like cavity wall insulation usually pays back in around about 2.5 years, depending on the type of house. So actually there's a really quick payback in terms of both carbon and finance for people involved.
Speaking of energy, I need to take off my insulated socks because I am starting to get super hot in the sun. You mentioned heat pumps, Tom. I'm curious about their magic.
They are just the most astonishing bit of equipment. The really important thing to know about is that they are hyper, hyper efficient. So you've probably seen on your gas boiler things like, oh, it's 95% efficient. So actually what that means is that when you put the gas in and you burn the gas, 95% of that will be converted into usable heat. If you use a classic electric heater, not a heat pump, you put 100% of electricity in and it will be 100% efficient because you don't have losses in there. A heat pump is normally around about 300% efficient.
Oh my gosh.
And it's because it's magic. and it's just crazy. So it uses the ambient temperature of outside, so just the normal temperature of the world.
Yeah.
And then puts it through these compressors and through these tubes, and all of a sudden it creates loads of heat. So basically, if you put in one unit of electricity, you'll get 3 to 4 units of heat out of it. And that is mind-blowing. And what it means fundamentally is actually it's really cost-effective when you think about gas, because one of the main things people say to me is, okay, heat pumps are powered by electricity. Electricity is more expensive than gas. Why would I get a heat pump? That's going to be expensive. But actually, if you imagine your gas is 7p a kilowatt, you need to be thinking, okay, my heat pump is going to be producing 4 times more heat per unit than the gas equivalent. So in reality, it's probably going to be a similar-ish price, somewhere about the 20, 28, 30p mark per kilowatt instead. So the price difference is not too radical.
And that's the marketing campaign for the government right there. With every magic heat pump, you get a free wizard on the inside that magically takes the heat out of the air and provides you with, 300% efficiency.
There are a few things you might have to change in your house to get a heat pump. So for example, you do need to have a relatively well-insulated house because they run at a lower temperature than a normal boiler. And then some people say that you need to oversize your radiator as well because it's running at a lower temperature. But the best advice I've ever heard about this, if you want to know if your house is suitable for a heat pump, turn your combi flow rate down or flow temperature down to 40 degrees and leave it at that for a few days. And that will be the temperature your heat pump will operate. If your house can stay warm at that 40 degree mark, then your house has got the right size radiators and the right sort of insulation to have a heat pump. So I'd also try and do this in winter as well.
That's great. You don't even need anybody to come into your house necessarily and do some specialized assessment, which would take place when you do get the heat pump anyway, but you can make that determination now.
Yeah. And there is lots of support out there to get heat pumps. So the one people might be familiar with is the £5,000 support from the government. And there's this idea that heat pumps are really expensive and that they are more expensive than a gas boiler. That's one of the issues with this. And we need to kind of upscale production to make them cheaper because as things grow, you get the economy of scale and they become cheaper. But with the £5,000 discount, in reality, they should be cheaper or have price parity at least with boilers. One of the issues we have at the moment is there is some controversy around various installers actually trying to take some of that government money. So they're still making people pay for more. But there's some really exciting stuff coming from Octopus recently as well, where they're basically saying, oh, let's just do it for the price we would do it and take the £5,000 off. And actually, people are getting a much more price equal option there with a heat pump. And I think it also brings us nicely onto the kind of ongoing discussion there is at the moment about what will the future of heating look like? Is it going to be hydrogen or is it going to be electric? And I don't know if there's something you've heard much of, PK.
I still think I need to learn a lot more about hydrogen energy. So yeah.
The one everyone wants to talk about at the moment is green hydrogen. So this is hydrogen, which is generated through this process called electrolysis, which uses magic electricity to make hydrogen.
Cousins of the original wizard and the heat pump.
Exactly, yeah. So it creates the hydrogen, which can then be burned. And it's effectively zero carbon because when you burn it, it doesn't create any greenhouse gases. It creates water and it is effective. But the amount of renewable energy you would need to create hydrogen, green hydrogen on the scale required for home heating is absolutely phenomenal. Somewhere in the region of four times the amount of electricity we would need to create green hydrogen compared to if we were to electrify our heating system instead. So it's just crazy the amount needed.
So that doesn't sound like a very feasible future energy solution.
So I think there's a chance it could be one of our solutions. And the reason I say that is because there's a lot of lobbying going on to make that be the case. There's lots of companies which say, we want hydrogen to be the future. And we have the money to say to government, this is what we should do.
So if hydrogen heating takes a lot of energy, even if it is renewable, that increases our energy demand. Again, I know it's renewable.
So yeah, it'll increase our energy demand. And as much as renewable energy is the solution in a major way, creating more of it for almost no reason has more embodied carbon in that process. Alongside that, if we were to move to hydrogen as a heating system, we would have to completely retrofit the gas network.
That was going to be my next question. How does it fit in with our current supply system?
And that's mainly because actually hydrogen is a really tiny, tiny molecule.
Yeah, it could seep out, couldn't it?
Exactly. It would just whiz out of any existing holes. And we already have a lot of gas leaks. And there's also just loads of concern about it from the public.
It's highly combustible.
Yeah. You just think about the airship exploding. Like, that's the thing that comes to mind.
Yeah.
And there was some amazing research done from the University of Newcastle a few years ago, trying to understand public concerns. And there was just so, so many. And even recently, there was a village that was going to be put onto hydrogen. And they said, nope. They basically came back and said, we don't want that. We don't want to be put onto hydrogen because it's terrifying.
We'd have to retrofit our current supply system. And additionally, there would be hurdles in public perception regarding its safety and efficacy.
Yes, but that's not to say we wouldn't also need to change our system for electrifying heating, because the national grid is in a pretty bad state, and not really fit for a whole like a huge extra demand. The best way that like, I think I've ever heard someone describe it is like if you imagine like the national grid's like a ponytail and there's individual hairs coming off the different areas, if we all of a sudden put more strain on the hairs, they are just going to just fry on the individual hairs, and we need more to kind of mix that strain up and make sure we can do it. But at the moment, we're just not built for a way for that strain to be spread.
Yeah, because we're continuing, each of us individually, using more and more energy per person for a variety of reasons. And then with a growing population, that's just going to burden the system.
So, as much as there are lots of things aren't up to standard, there are some changes on the way which might make a difference in terms of the general outlook for this. And there are two linked policies. The first one is really excitingly titled Part L of the Building Regulations. But basically, there's an update to it. All new homes will be have to produce 31% less carbon in their operation than was previously acceptable. And that's kind of an interim policy before we start in 2025 with the Future Home Standard, which is meant to be this really landmark policy to kind of change things. And in this one, we're looking for homes to actually have 75% less carbon emissions than under current regulations. With these policies in place, although they aren't as great as they first were, they are much better than they've ever been. So as long as we follow through with them in 2025 and get them in place, we have got some hope in terms of getting things moving forward in the right way. The things we need to make sure we move forward on really, really quickly are the finance and the funding for all of these things, the communication that we have with people generally to say this is important. And the other one that we haven't talked about at all, really, which really needs to be addressed, is planning, and actually how our planning system in the UK needs to be much better to make sure that, for example, councils don't face economic sanctions for failing to meet their housing targets, which kind of forces them to make really bad decisions on low carbon housing. More fundamentally, we need to rethink the way that we look at these ideas and think about the health benefits as well.
And when we're thinking about it, these are the health benefits that would impact us, our children, our grandchildren. So it's a good link. That's good news then about the policy.
It is, yeah, and we'll see how it goes.
So all of these things that we've talked about today are great. We need to understand them and we need to ensure they're sort of implemented for the future. But at this moment in time, what could you walk away with? You know, this podcast ends, and what can you do in your own home? So these are things to keep in mind to reduce your energy costs, reduce the demand of energy on our grid systems, but also the other effects it ends up having is that it creates a, you know, better, cleaner atmosphere, reduces healthcare costs as well. In terms of heating and your thermostat, if you turn it down by 1 degree, the UK can save £800 million. That's a lot of money in our pockets that we could be investing elsewhere. And with some of that money, you could replace your light bulbs if you haven't already. 100-watt LED light bulb uses about 75% less energy. So that is something perfect you could be doing immediately. There's also something called phantom load, and this is something we wanted to do in our home and have actually started doing much, much better, is when you go to sleep at night, turn off things like the outlet where your smart TV is hooked up to. You can turn off your microwave, your kettle, because there's phantom energy that's being used during that time that you're paying for. But again, that puts a burden on the system. Things like not using your dryer, air drying your clothes. You can also use a heated clothes air dry, which uses about 6 pence worth of energy per an hour. So that's something that can also help with damp. We know that drying your clothes in rooms in the wintertime can be a source of damp, which could create mold. But if you had a heated clothes air dryer, which looks very similar to your actual sort of standing dryer thing, you can have that up and it'll dry a lot faster. Another element you can do, and this is in terms of your water, is low flow shower heads and low flow sink faucet things. So that what that'll do is it'll use a lot less water, which is really valuable when you're using heated water, because about 20% of the total energy function in the home goes to heating, your cooking, your showering, your laundry. So if you have things that do low flow water, you'll be using a lot less of that. And any empty rooms that you have, if you have a guest room, turn that radiator down to very low. And you could even keep that door closed as well, which keeps, if it gets colder in that room, it's keeping that cold air from infiltrating the rest of the house. Those are some of the things that you can do to reduce your energy consumption.
And an easy way to track it. If you've got a smart meter, I've got an app called Loop Energy, which hooks up to it. And basically, it gives me all my energy data for the day. And it also tells me things like my phantom load. And it's actually quite cool, to be fair, because it tells me exactly like kind of what's going on. It doesn't tell you what devices are giving that phantom load, obviously, but it gives you a rough idea as to what's happening. I will warn you, with Loop Energy, they are trying to sell you some solar panels as well. So just ignore that stuff that goes on with it, unless you really want them, I guess. But there's also another one called Hugo Energy, which doesn't sell you anything, but it doesn't tell you your phantom load. But yeah, it's really useful to actually, okay, I can see how much energy I'm using throughout the day and understand where my peaks are, where my troughs are, and kind of make some decisions as well. Because you might actually start to see things which use loads of energy, which you didn't realize before. Like the one for me is when we got an air fryer with the air fryer craze of last year, you can kind of see the exact date on this app when I got the air fryer, because I've never used the oven again, basically. And you can see, oh, this is just a massive, massive difference in terms of energy saving. And air fried food is just so much better than oven food. Come on, let's be honest there as well.
I love that. The air fryer craze of 2022. Yeah, they do. Air fryers, pressure cookers, things like that use a lot less energy than your oven or your stovetop. I got my air fryer secondhand. So you can even buy them secondhand because people buy them and they don't use them. So you can even get one zero carbon. And I think there's a government scheme still going for smart meters. There might be a queue for it. So you can use an independent meter if you want to as well.
So there's been some really scary research published recently about the rebound effect, something we talked about in a previous episode, in homes which have been retrofitted. And actually, what it's showing is that once people have had their home retrofitted, there is a decrease in energy demand for several years, usually 2 to 3. And then after that, people start to increase the amount of energy they're using in their home to their previous level, basically because they're getting their house to a warmer temperature, but using the same amount of energy, so it's costing them the same. And this is something that's kind of popped up recently, which is quite scary, but something we should probably think about more in terms of making sure there's a long-term change in our habits once these sorts of things like retrofit have occurred.
Well, we're the smartest and most able species on the planet, so we can solve these things as well.
I don't know. Octopuses are pretty smart and they've got 8 legs. Like, imagine having 8 legs.
There's this amazing sci-fi book by Adrian Tchaikovsky. It's called Children of Time. It's a very philosophical book, but octopus play a huge role in that. How they think and how they move. It's almost like each tentacle has a different brain. So one can be solving some problem here and this one's going, but what's this over here?
What always blows my mind is the holes they can fit through as well. As long as the hole is bigger than their beak, which is just like a tiny thing, and they can just like mush their body around to get through it. Don't know how you do that.
So now I have a bit of a quiz for you, Tom, and I'm going to try to piece it together from all the things we haven't yet covered in our discussion. Between 2012 and 2019, new home installation decreased by 10%, 50%, 75%, or 95%?
I'd like to lock in answer C, 75%. I feel like it's quite bad, but I'm really hopeful it's not 95%.
It's 95%.
That's so bad. We have a heating and a climate emergency and we're like, nah, don't insulate those houses, leave them.
That's like backwards. Now, earlier in the episode, we talked about how the UK Energy Research Centre had said, you know, at the current rate, we're going to retrofit our homes so that the UK can have low carbon heating across the board would be 700 years. But at the rate we're going, Tom, just to insulate the most fuel poor homes, how many years do you think that will take? 25, 50, 75, 100. And this is also according to the UK Energy Research Centre.
I'm going to go for option C, 75 years. I feel like there's a lot of homes need to be done. And it's just happening so slowly at the moment that just, yeah.
Sadly, you're wrong again. Which I know this is painful, Tom. It's 100 years is their estimate at the current rate. Just to address the most fuel poor homes.
Wow.
True or false? Leaving your radiators on low all the time is more energy efficient than having them on a timer that turns them off and on during low peak and high peak times?
I'm gonna say that there's no correct answer to this.
I guess it would depend on the home. So according to the Energy Savings Trust, it's a myth that leaving your temperature on all the time at a steady constant is the best use of your energy. It should actually be on a timer, would be better, where you can have it timed to come on a couple hours before you get home to operate those areas. But for instance, you know, if our whole family is not in the home from 9 to 5, leaving that temperature on constantly could be a lot of energy.
It's one of those things, if you look at your smart meter as you're doing it as well, you can kind of work it out.
And I think that's exactly where the smart meter comes into play, because every house is different.
Definitely. It depends also how warm you want it. So in my house, my heating comes on in the morning. It gets us up to 17.5, and it doesn't come on again until the evening. And in the winter, it does mean it gets to about 12 degrees in the middle of the day, and that's not very nice. So you might want to make sure it clicks back on in between that time as well.
Yeah, so you'll have to adjust those things at different times of the year, depending on the season. Final question. If a family of four didn't use their dryer for 2 loads a week, how much could they save a year financially in terms of pounds? So family of four, could they save 100 pounds, 50 pounds, 75 pounds, 300 pounds?
300 pounds.
You're correct. Yeah, 300 pounds.
It's loads of money.
Yeah, it's 300 pounds.
It's always so nice this time of the year when you can get clothes back on the line. It's just bliss. Just we've got like a tiny little garden with like one tiny bit of light. And I basically have to rotate things throughout the day to try and get the one bit of light on the one bit of clothing to get them dry. But it's just so nice.
Yeah, it's nice. So you could save 300 pounds a year, a family of four, by reducing your dryer by two loads, which is yet another reason to get your kids and your family members to not wear something once and put that into the clothes bin.
But four times is going maybe too far.
Four times, yeah.
That's my limit.
It was this woman, she was going through her late mother's clothing, and it was a hanger that had all these clothespins, the wooden kind. And some of the pins had the number 1, some had 2, and some had 3. And every time she would wear a piece of clothing, she would stick one of those clothespins on the hanger so that she would know when it said 3, that was when the item should be washed. And I thought that was so brilliant.
Far too organized for me.
We just use the sniff test, the armpit sniff test.
Thanks for listening once again. If you've got any thoughts on what we've discussed in today's episode,
or would like to suggest some topics for future episodes,
email hello@theecocentrics.com.
Or look us up on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn.
And remember to hit follow so you never miss an episode.
See you next week.
Bye.
The Ecocentrics is produced by Emma Newman.
Theme and quiz music produced by Morgan Bryan.
And everything else on the Ecocentrics is performed by those busy wizards who, when they're not working on those heat pumps, they work for us.